So tonight's talk is called The Lion's Roar. And it's not about the magazine. There is a Buddhist magazine out there called The Lion's Roar, which I'm sure they got the name from this particular sutta that I'm going to talk about tonight. So this is the Kula Sihanada Sutta. Kula, the shorter. Siha is the lion and nada is the roar, the sound. So the shorter discourse on the lion's roar. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya, number 11. And in this discourse, the Buddha is explaining to his disciples how they should respond to monks of other traditions who ask why the Buddha's teachings are any better than the ones they follow. And I want to put this into context. In the Buddhist time, 2,500 years ago in North India, there were a wide variety of teachers and teachings and sects of all sorts, groups of all sorts, sanghas of different kinds. And this was just a part of an ongoing thing that was happening in the Buddhist time. There's a lot of, spiritual ferment going on at that time in North India. And so this would be something that would was common in terms of what would happen. Some member of the Buddhist Sangha would meet someone from a different Sangha, and the guy would say, "Well, welcome, yours is better than mine." There was like the usual discussions people would have, right? And the Buddha said that they should respond with the lion's roar. And so the lion's roar is, the lion roars as a warning and also shows courage and strength. So that's what he was telling his Sangha. That's how they should be. They should be strong and fierce like a lion when it came to dealing with other people. And what I want to do tonight is sort of work our way through this sutta. Because at the same time, that's what's going on. This sutta is also going through very precisely the main teachings of the Buddha when it comes to the first and second noble truths. It's sort of neatly disguised in this story he's telling. And I'll talk about that as we go along. So he's saying, this is from the sutta. Bhikkhus, only here is there a recluse. Only here a second recluse. Only here a third recluse. Only here a fourth recluse. The doctrines of others are devoid of recluses. That is how you should rightly roar, like your lions roar. So he's saying there's a few people in these other groups that are, have are legitimate. But most of them, there's not a lot. Whereas, of course, his group has, right? Then he goes on. It is possible, bhikkhus, that wanderers of other sects might ask, but on the strength of what argument, or with the support of what authority, do the venerable ones say this? Wanderers of other sects who ask thus may be answered in this way. Friends, four things have been declared to us by the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. On seeing these in ourselves, we say thus, only here is there a recluse, only here a second recluse. The doctrines of others are devoid of recluses. What are these for? We have confidence in the teacher. We have confidence in the Dhamma. We have fulfilled the precepts, and our companions in the Dhamma are dear and agreeable to us, whether they are laymen or those gone forth. These are four things declared to us by the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, on seeing which in ourselves we say as we do. So this is how we would justify roaring like a lion, right? So this is the beginning of things here. They have confidence in the teacher, the confidence in the teachings. Oh, look. Taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dhamma. Huh? They live a virtuous life on the precepts. So they have a life of virtue, which is, of course, where the Buddha always starts. I keep emphasizing this because it's so steady in the Buddha's teachings. He always starts everything with lead a virtuous life. And we have a connection to and love for the Sangha. So there's the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and then there's living the precepts out, actually living a life based on the precepts. And then the Buddha goes on. So this is like, well, that's pretty good, right? It is possible, bhikkhus, that wanderers of other sects may say thus, friends, we too have confidence in the teacher, that is, in our teacher. We have confidence in the Dhamma, that is, in our Dhamma. We too have fulfilled the precepts, that is, our precepts, and our companions in the Dhamma are dear and agreeable to us, whether they are laymen or those gone forth. What is the distinction here, friends? What is the variance? What is the difference between you and us? So the response they would get is, yeah, yes, but essentially, how come? I mean, this, you're not saying anything that we don't do too. This is exactly the same that we do. So then, of course, the Buddha goes on, right? And he then goes on to list a variety of other things. The Buddha goes through a list of other things that are important. Having only one goal, being free from lust, being free from hate, being free from delusion, free from clinging. As before, he admits that other sects may be equal in regard to understanding of these things. So here he's saying, well, he's going a little deeper into the teachings. He's saying, you need to be free of the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. These are the things that he emphasizes once again over and over. So this is like the next stage in the practice. Once you have faith in the teacher, once you have taken refuge and you're living a life of virtue, then you start to see the three poisons clearly, and you start to free yourself of those poisons. And then, so that's the beginning of the sutta. And of course, the other monks are going to reply, yeah, but that's exactly what we do too. There's no difference between what you're doing and what we're doing. That's what our teacher says. So then the Buddha goes on and he talks about the four aspects of clinging, which is sort of the whole basis of the second noble truth. So remember, the first noble truth is, that the truth of suffering, and the second noble truth is, we suffer because we cling. And so he spends the rest of this sutta basically talking about what it is we cling to. Why is it that clinging is so dominant in these teachings? And he goes on, he says, bhikkhus, there are four kinds of clinging. What for? Clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, and clinging to a doctrine of self. Though certain Rukhlases and Brahmins claim to propound the full understanding of all kinds of clinging, they do not completely describe the full understanding of all kinds of clinging. They describe the full understanding of clinging to sensual pleasures without describing the full understanding of clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, and clinging to the doctrine of self. Why is that? Those good Rukhlases and Brahmins do not understand these three instances of clinging as they actually are. So he's saying, well, everybody who's become a recluse, they understand the problems with clinging to things in the sense world. Because and the problem with them, of course, is that what we do, perhaps unconsciously, is we get caught in this idea that if we can just somehow or other figure it out so that we only have all the good stuff. And that's all we have. We sort of create this perfect life for ourselves. Then we'll be happy. And of course, we all know that doesn't work. Because, you know, as soon as we find something that brings us happiness, and it's not, and this isn't denying there isn't wonderful things in terms of sensual pleasure in the world. Doesn't deny that for a second. But those things, because everything is impermanent, keep disappearing. We think we've got it all figured out. We've got, if I just have this and I have this and I have this and blah, 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 I can fit it all together. And we might even for a moment or two, or even a day or two, who knows, have it all together. It seems like we have it all together, right? And then something changes and it all falls apart. Just like that. And this is why it doesn't work. It's like, we keep thinking it's what we can experience through our senses that's going to make us happy. And it does moment to moment. There are times, like I said, I'm smelling this yummy cake my wife is making in the background here. And it's like, I'm just sitting here. Yeah. One of my favorite zucchini cake smells, right? It's wonderful just to smell it. But, you know, a couple of days from now, well, maybe 3 days from now, that cake will be gone. Hopefully it'll be 3 days. But it's like, but then it's gone. It's going to disappear like everything else. So in the moment, it's quite pleasant, but it's always going to disappear. And so this idea that sense pleasures can make us permanently happy if we only figure out how to do it just leads us astray. And we get caught in that cycle of believing this over and over and over again. And so what the Buddha is saying is, well, sure, these other recluses understand that, but they don't understand the other three forms of clinging. Clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, and clinging to a sense of self, the doctrine of self, as it calls it here. And so then the sutta goes on. Though certain recluses and Brahmins claim to propound the full understanding of all kinds of clinging, they describe the full understanding of clinging to sensual pleasures and the clinging to views without describing the full understanding of clinging to rules and observances and clinging to the doctrine of self. So he says, well, you know, some of them go a little further. He's just trying to teach these four forms of clinging in this way that he's sort of being very progressive. It's sort of a certain style, right? So the second thing we cling to are views and opinions. And this is more subtle. I mean, we can all sort of understand that the teachings on clinging to sensual pleasures ultimately doesn't work. But views and opinions, now it's like, first of all, what does he even mean by this, right? And this is where we sort of have more deep-seated, long-standing ideas about how things are, or how things should be, even more. And these views and opinions, we cling to them because they're sort of our identity, right? We cling to ideas based on our upbringing. We cling to things, views and opinions based on our political views. We cling to things based on our religious views. That we cling to things based on our views and opinions about sexuality and on and on and on and on. Think of the infinite list. My hockey team is better than any other hockey team. That's just a view. And people cling to things like that. I mean, really, it's like you start insulting someone's hockey team, at least where I come from in Canada, you get into big trouble, right? Here, I suppose it would be football here or basketball or something. Same story. We have these ideas of how things are and what's right and what's wrong. And we don't see how limited these things are and how they limit us. Because we think we know what's right, when someone acts in a different way or speaks in a different way, then we know it's right. Then we compare ourselves to them. We think we're better than them. We argue with them. People get into fights with them. I mean, you think about most of what's going on in the world right now, where people are sort of doing and acting in really inappropriate and sometimes quite violent ways. It all comes out of just views and opinions. It all comes out of, I know I'm right. My philosophy, my holy book says this. I'm right. I know I'm right. Sorry, you're wrong. You know, the Dalai Lama has this thing where he says, when you get caught thinking that way, see if you can expand your views. And instead of having just one view, see if you can see six sides. You'll see it from above and below, left and right, front and back. See if you can see it from all these different angles and see if that gives you a wider perspective where you can go, yeah, this is what I've grown up believing, or what I believe, or how I've come to believe from what I've studied, or whatever. But I can see that there's other ways of looking at things that are equally valid. That my understanding is just that, mine. It isn't like the, it isn't like the only, which is where people get caught all the time in this area. We're so convinced. And the thing about views and opinions is they are sort of below the surface. What you might see sometimes are called latent defilements. They're latent in that, like, they're not obvious. Because, this is, well, we've grown up this way, Or, well, of course it's that way. That's when you have a thought or a discussion and you hear yourself saying or thinking, well, it's always been that way. Well, or of course it's that way. Everybody knows that. This is your signal to be mindful of, oh, is this just a view and opinion? Is this the something, that I've always believed because I've always believed it? But is it really true? Is it really valid? Or is it just that, just some idea floating around in my head that has no ultimate reality or validity? When I think of this, there's this great saying from the third Zen patriarch. I really like this. He says, "Do not seek the truth, only cease to cherish opinions." You don't need to seek the truth. You just have to stop cherishing your opinions. Let those go, and truth will arise by itself. Think it's a great, the third Zen patriarch's full of juicy statements like this. So that's the second thing. So then the Buddha goes on, of course, and it says, yeah, but then, some people are going to say, yeah, our teachings acknowledge that as well. And so then he goes on to the third level, which he says, what he calls rites and rituals. Well, in the Buddha's time, remember he's talking about Brahmins here, as, Brahmins and recluses. And in the Brahmanic culture that the Buddha lived in the midst of, and where he came from, I mean, he was a Brah, you know, lived in the, he was a high caste, warrior caste Hindu, originally, beginning. Within that caste system, the Brahmins had rites and rituals for pretty much everything. Take a look at the Vedas, the Rig Veda in particular, and it's just like full of thousands of things. Like, if you want to have a male child, do this. If you want your crops to grow, then the priest will come and do these rituals, and et cetera, et cetera. And this, it was like everything. Everything had embedded in it, in the culture, rites and rituals on to make them work. And of course, these could only be performed by the Brahmins, because they were the only ones who could read the texts, because they were the only ones who had learned Sanskrit, which is all this was written in Sanskrit. And they were the ones that learned it and taught it and continued. So they sort of had a monopoly on rites and rituals. And Buddha said, nah, not true. And very strongly fought against this whole cultural idea. And he did it in ways that infuriated the Brahmin caste. He would initiate people from any caste, including outcasts, which were like the lowest of the low. He would initiate women, gasp, which was like basically women were told in the Brahmanic culture, well, next lifetime, if you come back as a man, maybe you can learn some of this stuff. Until then, just take care of the cows and the children, and be a good wife. That was what they were told. And he just ignored all of this. He just totally said, nope, none of this. And so he's pointing to the fact that many of the other recluses and teachers in that time didn't do this. They were still deeply embedded in the culture. And he had sort of, in a sense, stepped outside that culture. Not completely, but quite a lot, especially when it came to the caste system and the views on women. And he said this is another thing people cling to. They cling to this is how things are done. But this is sort of like a special subclass of views and opinions had to do specifically with the religious teachings of that day. And to be honest with you, to this day in India, I mean, there's still, even though the caste system was outlawed in the early 50s in India, it's still very much active. Not only in India, by the way, it's active right here in the United States. There are big issues around people of different castes who are all from India working together, and how the people of lower castes are treated by the people of upper castes. To this day in the United States, it's just part of, it's the cultural, deeply embedded cultural set of beliefs. But what is, so that's back in India, and to this day, if you happen to grow up in that culture. But what about the rest of us? What does this mean for us, regular Western people? And I think when I think of this in that context, I think about what I'll call the spiritual culture, that I suspect we're all to some extent part of. That I grew up, and then I, in the Protestant tradition, but then I grew up in the 60s and 70s, so of course I was a hippie. And that whole world was like wide open to all kinds of interpretation of different spiritual ideas and different ways of doing things. And, we had to just love everyone all the time, right? It was like that was the hippie thing. Everybody's got to love everybody all the time. And I'm full of love. I've got nothing but love. Love is all there is, which is like ignoring the fact that, half of what's in people is the opposite, right? It totally ignores the dark side completely, but and doesn't acknowledge it at all. And the Buddhist teachings very clearly do acknowledge that what we're working with, greed, hatred, and delusion, we all have that, and we're learning to overcome, work with it, and skillfully overcome it. And also within this spiritual culture, there are certain beliefs that are deeply embedded in this spiritual culture that are really problematic. The one I think is the biggest one, the biggest problem is everything has a reason. Everything has a reason. Well, no. I run into, I'm a hospital chaplain part-time. I run into this all the time. I'm always having discussions with patients. I hang out mainly in the cancer ward. So this is a pretty long, typical question. It's like, why me? Or even more horrible, why do I deserve this? Because if everything has a reason, I must deserve to be suffering in this way or dying in this way, as often is the case. And it takes a while for me to get to be able to say to them and them to sort of take in, there's no reason. Life is just totally random. I mean, it's not, you're not being punished. You're not, there's not like, the world isn't fair. This isn't mean anything other than this is the cards you got dealt. And now you do the best to work with what you've got. And for some people, this is such a relief when they hear something like that, because they've just been racked with guilt because people have told them, that they're sick. These things that are happening to them right now are because they deserve it. That there's a reason for it, and they've brought it on themselves. This is insidious culture. And it's not true. And the Buddha very clearly says that. There's this great, this is all, bound up in ideas of karma and that sort of that stuff as well. I don't want to go there right now, but the idea that everything is sort of predestined, and of course it's gonna, I got this because of what I did 3 lives ago when I hit that person with a stick or something. I mean, people, amazing how deeply people believe some of these things. Or that God is punishing them for something they did, or something their family did, or their culture did. There's this, that sort of layer of culture as well. And it just totally gets in the way of healing and of being connected to reality. We cling to these ideas, and then we have to, when we're caught in the experience of them, it's like, oh, this isn't, it's so unhealthy to cling to those sorts of ideas. So that's the third layer, the third. And the Buddha said in the sutta again, he says, oh, but of course, other teachers, their students in convexity, well, our teacher taught teaches that too. He wasn't the only one in his time in North India who was saying these things about the fact that, these ideas of rites and rituals being the only way to deal with things were incorrect. He was not alone in that. He was one of the stronger proponents, perhaps. But then he says, okay, but here's one more. And he talks about this idea of a sense of a separate self. And I should read the sutta here. This idea of the doctrine of clinging to self, the idea that somehow we have this separate self and we cling to this idea of having a separate self, that it's somehow real. And this is where the Buddha says, no one else. This is what truly differentiates the teachings of the Buddha from other doctrines. This is where the lion's roar really comes down to, is this teaching he was giving on this idea of no such of not self was the thing that differentiated his teachings from all the other teachings that were currently going on in North India at that time. And I want to read a couple of little things here. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, The Experience of Insight. And he's just talking about this fourth form of clinging. The fourth of the bonds, and the most subtle, the most deeply conditioned, is our attachment to the belief in self, in I, in me, in mine. The belief that there is some permanent entity in the mind body which is experiencing all this. Because of this belief, and to satisfy the I, the self, we get involved in all kinds of unwholesome actions, all kinds of greed and hatred, all kinds of delusion, for the gratification of the self which isn't even there. Our attachment to the concept of self is so great that everything we do revolves about it, tying the bonds ever tighter. And you think about, when our sense of self gets affronted, attacked, that's when we often react more strongly than any other time. It's like we have this idea of who I am. I'm this person who believes this and has this, and this is the kind of person I am. And, I'm a good person, and this person is saying I'm not a good person, and we get really upset. This is where we create a lot of our own suffering, because people say things. For whatever reason they're saying them, or they act in ways that make it obvious that's what they think. And we get really distressed because they're dissing me. They're saying something that isn't true in my mind, that it's not the way I know I am. I am. And this is where we create a lot of our own suffering, because we're reacting, we are so reactive to people challenging our sense of a separate self, of who I am. And this is the hardest one to see, because, well, of course that's who I am. I'm who I am. I am what I am, and it's all that I am. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man, but it's like, that's what we get caught in believing that so deeply that we can't see that there might be an alternative. That there's this sense of a separate self is just as delusive as anything else. And it's related to something else. This is another thing from Joseph Goldstein. And this is what he calls the craving for becoming, for renewed existence. And on one level, we're acting out this craving all the time. Every time we wake up, oh, I'm awake again. Here I am renewing my existence. Think of it that way. It's like that's an interesting way to think about it, but it's like that's part of what happens when we wake up. Okay. This is the very basic urge or desire to be. It is the desire for continuing existence, particularly in pleasant realms. We may not believe in rebirth and different planes of existence, although they are mentioned often in the Buddhist teachings, but we don't have to believe in them in order to experience this powerful craving for becoming. We can see it in the planning mind, in the act of imagining ourselves in some future situation. We might be planning for something at work, or perhaps for our next vacation. It all starts with just a thought, and then weeks or months or even years later, a whole chain of thoughts and actions has materialized in our lives. Notice how often we get lost in mind fantasies of a future self. I'll do this, I'll go there. Losing ourselves in these projects is a manifestation of craving for becoming. In a sutta called One Fortunate Attachment, the Buddha gave clear advice for freeing ourselves from this craving. Let not a person revive the past or on the future build his hopes, for the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let him see each presently arisen state. Let him know that to be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably, be in the present moment. In other words, one who dwells thus all ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, he is the peaceful sage, has said, who has one fortunate attachment. In other words, our only attachment is to the present moment. What would it be like to live with what that one fortunate attachment, not reviving the past, not hoping to be in the future? On a momentary level, we can see this craving for becoming in our relationship to the unfolding process itself. Even if we don't have expectations for some big, wonderful experience, how often do we seem to be leaning forward into the next moment as if somehow the next step, the next breath, the next sensation or thought will resolve everything, complete everything? We see this leaning happen when we're feeling something unpleasant and watching for it to change. Or we see it when we're being with some emotion and wanting to feel it more deeply. That's an interesting set of thoughts there, huh? It's like we lean into the next moment instead of paying attention to the current moment. We're always looking for something more. Partly this is because about 80% of what we experience is like boringly neutral. And we're sort of so conditioned to, I want some action. Yeah, give me something exciting. You know, I don't want to just sit here and live in neutral land all the time. The sense of leaning forward, anticipating the next moment, it's also a kind of craving for becoming. Here we're not seeing each of these experiences simply as an insubstantial, empty phenomena arising and passing in each moment. We're living in a world of wanting. We forget that liberation is not about becoming or getting, but not about holding on or craving or clinging, but about letting go, letting be. The great Indian Saint Ramana Maharshi put it very simply, to be less, not more. That's what we're trying to do, to be less, not more. We also see this craving for becoming, I think, when we misunderstand the teachings on karma and rebirth, rebirth in particular. So often the ideas we have around rebirth have to do with I, this personality, Barry, is going to be reborn. There's going to be a new Barry. Once this Barry is gone, there'll be a new Barry. Lucky world, there'll be a new Barry, right? Oh boy. And that's not what the teachings on rebirth are actually saying. They're saying that the collective karmic energy of this life, which is being added to this bundle of karmic energy that came with us when we were born, that goes on, will be attached to a new body at some point. But that body is going to be a unique personality that has, you know, may have little traits of Barry floating around in there someplace because they're so deeply embedded, but isn't going to be Barry at all. The idea that I'm going to be reborn is a very subtle clinging to a sense of self. Because, well, maybe, you know, if nothing else, I can believe, yeah, you know, I can sort of get into this not-self stuff, but I'm going to come around again. I'm going to be, there's going to be another me. This is just clinging to a sense of self. This idea that I'm going to go on forever. I'm just going to keep getting reborn and reborn. I'm just going to go on forever and ever without ever ending. And that's also deeply embedded. It's a cultural belief, especially in this quote spiritual world that we were talking about earlier. There's also another way of looking at this. I think just we can touch on this lightly. There's also sometimes when things aren't going well, in particular in people's lives, they get a craving for non-existence, which is the opposite, but just the flip side of the coin from the craving for existence. It's just the same thing flipped over. The negative image, but it's exactly the same stuff. People come to the place where they don't want to, I want to end this existence. Is a belief that this existence is solid, and then I have to end it. This is just another thing, way to look at things in a slightly different way. I haven't explored this idea a lot, but I was reading some commentary and went, oh, I never thought of it quite that way, but it really makes sense to me. It's like, that's what a craving for non-existence is, basically the craving for existence in reverse. I'm tired of having this existence. I want to get rid of it. But it's not... those are two related ideas that are just two sides of a coin. Anyhow, so this is where the you know, in this sutta, this is where the Buddha kept says very clearly, this is what differentiates my teaching from all these other teachings. This is where the lion's roar really comes from. It comes from this understanding of this sense of not-self. This is where a lot of the practice, the teachings on practice, lead us somewhat gently towards understanding this. And we have to keep that in the back of our mind. And also make sure that we don't, that we don't get caught in like, wait a sec, this doesn't make sense. You know, Joseph Goldstein says, "It's if nothing else, we have to suspend our disbelief. We don't have to believe it. It's not like doctrine. You've got to believe it or you're going to get kicked out of the Buddhist church, right? No, this is not, this is something we, eventually at some point, we will grok in some way, take it in some way that is organic and internal. And until then, if we can just suspend our disbelief and see if we can lean in that direction, that's all that's necessary. So don't feel like, oh, well, this, because I, to be honest, this is where I struggle with the Buddhist teachings more than anything else. It's like, yeah, it makes sense to me, I understand it, but experience it? Well, maybe a little bits once in a while, but it's not like something that's my daily companion or anything like that. Yeah. The Buddha goes on. Now, these four kinds of clinging have what as their source? What is their origin? What are they born from? What are they born and produced? These four kinds of clinging has craving as their source. Craving as their origin. They are born and produced from craving. Craving has what as its source? Craving has feeling as its source. Feeling has what as its source? Feeling has contact as its source. Now he's talking, he's just shifted, and now he's talking about the cycle of how things are always arising. The 12 steps of codependent arising. He's saying something arises. There's contact at one of the sense doors. And then feeling tone, vedana, arises, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And based on that pleasant or unpleasant, we get into craving or aversion or delusion. If it's neutral, we go, eh, who cares? And that leads to clinging and so on. So this is like the cycle we're go constantly going through. And this is the other part, I think, of the Buddhist teaching that's quite unique. Is I've never encountered any other place that talks so openly about this cycle of, codependent arising, where contact, we can't avoid contact. We can, put on an eye mask and stick things in our ears and stuff, but we're still going to have sensation no matter what we do. We can't avoid contact. And so Vedana, this feeling tone, always is going to be there. It's a separate event from the contact itself. And if we can see that Vedana, then we have this choice to react or not react. We don't have to fall into craving and clinging. If we can just see that, oh, yes, that's a pleasant experience. That itch on my nose is unpleasant, or whatever it is that you're experiencing, and not get caught in the reactive energy that we're so habitually used to, because that always leads to clinging. It's the chain of events. So he's just reminding of this other teaching of his, essentially. And then he says, Bhikkhus, when ignorance is abandoned and true knowledge has arisen in a bhikkhu, then with the fading away of ignorance and the arising of true knowledge, he no longer clings to sensual pleasures. He no longer clings to views. He no longer clings to rules and observance. He no longer clings to the doctrine of self. When he does not cling, he is not agitated. When he is not agitated, he personally attains nibbana. He understands birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There's no more coming to any state of being. This is a classic declaration of nibbana, of enlightenment, and illumination. Pick your favorite word. He's saying, when we stop clinging, this is the second noble truth, and the third noble truth. When we stop clinging, clinging is the cause of suffering. When we stop clinging, when we truly stop clinging, then we're free. That's what enlightenment means, in one sense, one definition of enlightenment. Simply, if we just stop, all we have to do is stop clinging, he says casually, right? And I'm sure I've said this before, but to remind you, there is this the Buddha, when he talked about his final enlightenment, when he first became enlightened, said the last thing he had to let go of was a subtle sense of a separate self. So it's going to take a while. We work on this. It's like we have, if we can just get, turn off that disbelief. If we can just go, I'm going to suspend my disbelief. If I'm just going to sort of take in this idea and see what happens and see from in the context of what I experience the validity or of this idea, not as an intellectual idea, but as an experiential one. It has to start with the intellect. We have to understand the teachings. But then we have to experience them somehow. And that's through the practice. I'll finish with a little bit of poetry, of course. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. Sooner or later, life in its variety and wisdom chews the meat from the bones of my illusions. It sucks the marrow from inside and throws the dry bone to bleach in a pile. Expectations are treated with equal disdain. Stripped of their finery, they reveal as nothing more than future plans, Easy ways to stay safe. Roadmaps drawn by a blind cartographer trying to imagine distant destinations. This is the present moment's boot camp. Life's lack of rules will be obeyed, or I'll spend my time peeling potatoes in the past. I can choose to leave behind the skeletons of what I thought I knew and raise the flag of truth on the front porch. I can take a single step and wait for the next one to be revealed. I can only know where I am in this moment. Anything else is a desperate attempt to clothe the bones and set them walking. I think the key line here is, I can take a single step and wait for the next one to be revealed. That's all we can ever do. Just take a single step. And what happens now? Just pay attention to what arises. I took that step, now what arises? See what happens. That's the ideal that he presents in the Buddhist teachings. We can't sort of like magically take it all in at once. It's little by little by little. And this teaching and practice is like that. It's very progressive. It's very little bit, little bit, little bit, little bit. And then you go, oh, I never thought of it quite that way before, or I never saw it quite that way. I never experienced it quite that way before. And some of these teachings become organic, ingrained, as opposed to intellectual ideas. We know them in a very different way. And that just takes time. We just keep taking those little single steps and seeing what happens. That's all we can do.